Thank you, Jude. Hi, everybody, and welcome along to the class today. So as you know, we've been doing this course, and I think it's today's class four on establishing a daily practice. So this module called Establishing Daily Practice is number 8 in a series of 14. And so everything's been sort of leading up to this. So if you don't have any commitments as a Buddhist practitioner, but you would like to do a daily practice, then this class is to sort of support you in that. We'll begin as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation, and then we'll take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment. We'll say a couple of other prayers and then we'll begin the class. So just get comfortable in your seat. Just make sure your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. And you can keep your eyes open or you can close them, whatever seems more natural and easier for you. And once you are comfortable in your seat, allow yourself to breathe normally and naturally. And while you are breathing normally and naturally, become aware of any movement or feeling within the body that will arise whenever you inhale or exhale. And so we're breathing like this so that we can relax a little more and at the same time have the mind focused. And so the body relaxing and the mind focused upon the breath. Continue to breathe normally and naturally. You'll find yourself relaxing each time you exhale breath. Each time you inhale, you'll be aware of movements and feelings within the body that take place whenever you breathe inwards. Now the body and mind relaxed and the mind a little more focused, think about why you are here today. In other words, recollect your intention for being here. Then, having reminded yourself of why you're here, imagine that all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are also present and that you're surrounded by all living beings. And include within your intention a wish to become fully awakened, a wish that your compassion and your wisdom and all of your skills have been heightened and perfected to be used for the welfare of all living beings. And as a means for bringing about this perfection, think that you'll direct your life in the direction of the previous Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, in the Dharma that they've taken, and in the spiritual community. Think that they're present and that we're going to lead all the beings who surround us in taking refuge together. We can say this together. We can do it in English. We'll just recite the reference prayer and the generation of bodhicitta three times together. It's up on the screen if you have your eyes open. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, to stabilize this wish and to enhance it, consider the four immeasurable thoughts. In other words, if you wish all immeasurable numbers of sentient beings to experience love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and that those who haven't, you will establish them in those states. Then see yourself prostrating before the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Imagine yourself making offerings to them. And then confessing, laying down the burden of any past unskillful activity. Rejoicing in the merit of yourself and every other living being. If you have other wishes, then request them now. And then dedicating whatever you're doing here today and for the rest of your life to attaining enlightenment for the benefit of others. Then we're going to make a mandala offering. So I think that the purpose behind this is to provide resources throughout our countless lives, to stop our greed and miserliness, and all types of clinging that we have to the body, our conceptions of true existence, and to merit to be truly ours. For this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Iram Guru Rata Mandala Kamayata Yomi. So we release the offering. It's accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they smile at us with delight. So while they're smiling at us, let's look up into their eyes. So the Buddha's looking directly at you, and I want you to feel accepted in his gaze and to feel at ease. Now an emanation leaves the heart of the Buddha, moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head. Descends, entering the crown, coming down to the level of your heart. And then the radiance of the Buddha's body begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light. The light goes out through the pores of your skin, fills the 10 directions of space. And every being within space arises in an enlightened state. Sense of joy pervades your body and mind, thinking how wonderful it is that I've established all beings within the state of enlightenment. There's no difference between yourself and anyone else. And the light begins to withdraw, re-enters your heart, and you feel embodied sitting on the seat. the wilds all this took place on the level of imagination, but nevertheless, I've established the seed for awakening. So today and tomorrow and for every other day of my life, I'm going to put into practice what I study so I can become awakened and bring about the welfare of others. So with that, breathe in deeply through your nostrils and exhale through the mouth. Your eyes are closed, allow them to flutter, and wake yourself up and move your hands and feet and your body in whichever way you like and become comfortable in the seat. So, welcome, people online and people in the room. And we'll have a look at what we've done in the previous 3 weeks. So we looked at what Dharma is. So Dharma is a Buddhist term for the teachings of the Buddha. And the teachings are of two types, a scripture and a realization. And the Dharma itself, the meaning of Dharma is to hold. So Dharma is to hold us back from suffering. We looked at the speech blessing, and we've looked at a couple of the preparations. These have been like cleaning the room, setting up an altar, and making offerings. We've also each week looked at some of the different practices you can do between the sessions. So in other words, when you go to sleep at night, when you walk through doors, when you walk on the floor, there's all different ways of thinking that you can turn those simple activities into the Dharma. Now today we're going to have again look at everyday Dharma. We're going to focus on the bathroom today. Then we can also look at the different seats, how you sit, what you can sit on, the different postures, and the motivation you need to bring to meditation and the different types of visualizations. And I base this talk upon teachings I've had in the past, but also these books here that I found them very useful. Now, the two down the side there called Everyday Dharma and A Method to Transform
a Suffering Life into Happiness, Including Enlightenment.
That's right. So those are both my lamas open for Shay. That's what this course is sort of based upon. Now, this book in the middle, a big blue one, Study and Practice of Meditation. So that's the most comprehensive book I've come across on meditating, especially in terms of developing what we call karma vidhi or states of concentration. It's got a lot about the posture, how to sit, the different meanings, common and uncommon and so forth. But it's a bit like a science textbook. So it's not easy reading. It's not really great, enjoyable reading, but it's in depth. Coming down a bit next to it, the posture of meditation is a much simpler one. And this is very, very good, easily readable. And right next to it, called Pain-Free Sitting, Standing and Walking, is fantastic. If you have difficulties sitting, if you have difficulties meditating, that's a good book to get, because you can find you can do exercises before you sit, and it makes it a lot easier for you. The two other books up the top, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment and Walking Through Walls, both of those two are quite in-depth on the posture and how to meditate and so forth, all the details. Now, these are the practices we do as preparation for the meditation session. So we've looked at how to clean the room and why you clean the room, what you can say as you clean it. You know, dust out, dirt out, dust out. And you're cleaning the room to really clean your mind up. You set up the altar and you put the offerings on it. Today, we're going to focus on the posture. After posture, just as we did here, so you've all sat down, we took refuge together and we generated an altruistic attitude. So we'll talk about that a bit more next week. After that, we'll follow what they call the seven limbs. And the requests and the mandala offering. So we'll go through those as the weeks come up, but today we're focusing on the posture. Before we do that, we can focus on everyday Dharma. So every day we're going to go to the bathroom, we're going to go to the toilet. So when you go in there, the first thing you're going to do is open the door. And then you often should close the door. So when you close the door, you say, I am closing the door to the lower realms. So you close the door for yourself, you say, in other words, I'm not going to do anything foolish or silly, so I don't end up in a lower realm rebirth. So I'm going to close the doors. And this, let's symbolize by just closing the door. The second one, of course, they're going to sit on the toilet. Now, as you can see in our toilets, we've got all these little messages. So you can say a lot of different things. Because often, when you're in the toilet, you're going to do a number of different things. As a general, I think there's 3 or 4 different things you can do. And you can say something each time.
So make sure you use each one of our toilet stalls over your visit to Lumbri Tapa Centre, because each one has a different message in it, as well as different decorations.
Yeah. So you can use going to the loo as a way of practicing Dharma. So one of them, I mean, there's different mantras you can say, but there's just different ways of thinking also. So the simple one is, may I liberate all beings from the rivers of birth, sickness, aging, and death. So put those 4 things in there, because it's basically 4 things you can do in the loop. So you go, what are they? But you say each, yeah, and so you get 4 things for. There's different ways, as you can see, if you go to the loos here, there are different ways of looking at it. So just find one that's simple that you can remember.
I just remember Geshe Tata Seri saying about the going to the toilet, not pleasant, but important. Like important physically, but then also inescapable. So turn it into everyday Dharma.
Yeah, remember when I was at school, we're talking about happiness, you know. So my best mate said to me, so we're going, what makes you really happy? And, you know, it's really hard to answer. So then the answer is going to the loo. And I went like, what? What a weird thing to say. Like we're about, 13, 14. And that's what he said. And because he was my best mate, I liked him and respected him, I went away and thought about it. I think, what's that mean? And I thought, well, imagine when you can't go, but you really want to go. Now, that's really unpleasant. So, that's right. It's a release, it's a necessary thing, isn't it? Because, like, a lot of suffering comes if you can't go to the loo.
Then he said, if only my 2 boys would close the door to the lower roll rebirths more often.
That's right. Well, maybe she could yell that out to them. Yeah. Close the door on the lower realms. So it's lots, it's a simple thing we do it every day. And this is another thing we often do. So we go to the loo, we always wash our hands, and often, if you wake up in the morning, you'll end up washing your face. So here's the next thing you can say. May I remove the 2 obscurations from each and every living being and bring them to perfect enlightenment.
Is that like the 2 hands and 2 obscurations?
Yeah, so use 2 hands, 2 obscurations. You could say, reveal to them the 2 truths and achieve the 2 bodies of a Buddha. So I always try and find things like that. If you get the numbers, like it's a simple way of remembering. There's so many different numbers in Buddhism, isn't there? There's 2 of this, 2 of that, 2 of that, 3 of this, 3 of that, 4 of that, 6, 7. There's heaps of them. So it's a simple way of also reminding yourself, okay, I've got these 2 hands, that's method and wisdom. I wish to reveal the 2 truths to myself, retain the 2 bodies of Buddhahood, to free all beings from the truth of suffering and the truth of origin. You can just keep adding and making it bigger and bigger. So a very simple thing can bring you a lot of joy, whereas before you were just washing your face.
Well, it's very skillful, isn't it, to associate the nice feeling of cool water on your face with this kind of ultimate kind of prayer.
Yeah, otherwise, especially if you don't, you're just going from the attachment to this life, aren't you? You know, it's a pleasant feeling. You like it, and that's it.
That's it. Or your prayers just become very dry.
So you make say, remember, heaven, these prayers are often aspirations. We're reminding ourselves to do things. We're not waiting, oh, please, Buddha or God, make me something. It's like, may I wake myself up and wake other people up. So it's more, these prayers are like reminders. So that's what we've done for our Dharma, for daily Dharma today. Going to the loo, washing your hands, washing your face. So I just want to do, like, you know, as you've seen each week, it's just a couple of things. So you can go away and you can remember at least two things, right? If I give you the whole lot in one day, you just forget most of it. Okay, so let's now come to the session, right? Now, of course, just as you are and I am, in fact, we all are, we're all sitting down. Now, the practice of Dharma doesn't always take place when you're sitting down, but when you're meditating, it often does. But you can meditate walking, standing, or even lying down. So we're going to look at some of these different postures and what you can use when you meditate. But first, we'll look at what to sit on. So here, as you guys are, you're on chairs, which we'll come up and show very shortly. But most often, you sit like on the floor with your legs in some sort of posture. So here we have the more sort of, we've got the Burmese way of sitting, we've got the Tibetan way of sitting, and we've also got like a Thai way of sitting. So some you can see the legs are completely crossed, which they're called Vajra in the Tibetan system. We have a half lotus, which is often done by the Thai. And then we've got what they call the Burmese way. Sorry, the Burmese way is the more this, like I'm sitting now, one in front of the other. But there are others as well, as you'll see. So you can see we've got these stools on the side here where you can put, you tuck your legs underneath you. So you can sit on a stool or you can just sit on your legs.
But at least if you're on a stool, then the circulation doesn't stop under your knees.
Yep. And you can place your feet like directly under the stool or you can go outside the stool. And at the back there, you can see some meditation cushions, those long ones. So they're very good to sit on too. Like they're very firm, but they've got a little bit of give. And you can place your legs on, have this thing running, you know, in your legs on the outside of it. So that's very comfortable also. You can also sit on them and cross your legs in front. It's very comfortable. So we've got seats, in other words. We've got the long cushions. Finally, we've got chairs. So everyone is sitting on a chair. Now, when you're home, what's a very useful thing to do with the chair is what you can find is you start leaning back in the seat, which is not so good. You're better off to come forward a bit and sit towards the front. Not only that, if you can put something behind the back legs of your seat, so the seat gets tilted up a little bit.
So under the back legs.
Under the back legs. But if you've got a piece of 4x2, and put that out and put the back legs on, you get a great tilt. What's terrific about that is that you don't have to straighten your back. The back will naturally become straight. But you don't have to hold it up. It's like those chairs there. You sit on them because I've got a slant in the seat. Back just naturally goes up and your shoulders naturally fall down.
Or if you've got a computer chair, you know, like with all of its adjustable bits and pieces, you can put the seat at an angle so it tips slightly forward.
What you want to end up with, as we'll see shortly, is you want to have your hips higher than your knees. Now, we had... So many times when people come to meditation centers, they want to sit like the first row, you know, everybody on the ground with their legs crossed and so forth, looking cool. Mm-hmm. Except as you get older, it's harder and harder, especially if you haven't done it if you were young. Really, it's hard. And sometimes Westerners want to sit like the Tibetans do, which is this cross-legged, but you see when the geshis hop up there, they get the cushion, they throw it out. don't want a cushion, I want to sit flat like that. Now, this is a very bad idea for Westerners long term. So we had a Western woman who was coming to the centre, and then she became a nun, and she sat like that.
Without any cushion?
Without any cushion, just with her legs crossed. And we kept saying to her, look, put something underneath it. She said, no, I'm right. Within about 2 years, she wasn't able to walk. And she ended up lying on her back crook for years, and then in the end gave up being a nun. Because the stresses that are put on your lower back, and especially in this area here, running into your thighs, were immense. And she wasn't aware of it, right? This incredible tension. And then one day, it just, they gave out, and that was it. And then she actually couldn't get up. Yeah, of course, yeah. Your body's much more supple when you're a child. It's very easy to encourage children to look around, see what the adults are doing. They simply do it.
And your muscles develop that way. So you visited today Japanese students. So, you know, if I try and kneel, I'm in agony within about 2 minutes. There's just no way I can do it. And yet, you know, that's your most comfortable position. Yeah. So, yeah, how you've grown up. And so when the school kids come here for their, you know, annual visits and things like that, most of them can't actually sit on the floor or sit cross-legged because they just haven't grown up like that anymore. So when I was a kid, everybody sat on the floor cross-legged. It was easy. But now none of those school kids can sit cross-legged, and when they do, their knees are up around their ears. That's a real worry. So they clearly don't hang out on the floor much, probably, unless they're just lying down.
And sometimes we see in the magazines, especially when they're often advertising yoga, and so you get the Western women sitting there and their knees are up really high, and you go, that is not, that's a real bad,
terrible
posture, man. That's one of the worst things you can do to yourself, right? Because the weight of your knees is pushing down in here. So over time, your back will go out. That's what will happen. And you don't want something like that to happen. So it's just start off with a cushion and always look down to make sure are my knees below my waist? Are my hips up higher than my knees? It gets easier. Know that, like if you have the slant.
The slant, or Susan says, or you can use an ergodynamic chair.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all custom made like that, because office people also know hips got to be higher than your knees for a long-term sitting.
Yeah. Yeah, so sitting, it's important, especially if you start meditating for long periods of time. So what you often find is over the time, the natural tension that we have in our body will pull your shoulders up. We're just tight. So, and then you find, so you're holding all this tension in the body, which makes it very hard to meditate over time. But when you start feeling it, you'll have sore shoulders, you'll have a sore back, you'll have sore knees, you become aware of all the soreness in the body, basically. So oftentimes it's a good idea to do a few exercises beforehand, like tightening the body up first and releasing it and so forth. And find out where your tight spots are over time, and then go, okay, I need to work with that. And like get that book or something like it and go online and find, this is the area I'm tight on, what exercises can I do? There's heaps of stuff up online, which is quite simple to do too. So again, on the different seats, so here's some seats, and these bottom sort of maroon ones, we've got a lot of those here, as you see, we've got a number of them here, we sell them up in the shop. What I like about these is how you can break them down so you can carry them with you. Like if you go off to different places, it's great to have your own seat. If you've got a comfortable seat and you're used to meditating on it, well, why not take it with you? It's so much better than going to a place and you can't find anything comfortable to sit on. There's a thing there, like it's like a belt. So I had a minute when I first came to meditation, I couldn't sit like this, like I am now. I actually had one leg down, the other was up. So I was out of whack with one side of my body. So I got this meditation belt and kept it on for years. But gradually getting my knees down, gradually giving up, trying to take the belt off, and now it's quite natural. But it took years. And here you can see the different types of seat. So I've got a seat downstairs that a blow up. Because I thought if I'm going to go somewhere for
minutes. Like a Dharma whoopee cushion.
Yeah. So, and I've got that, and I've also got a like a mattress that's also a blow up. Because I think if I go somewhere, I want to like be able to take it with me in my suitcase. So just let the air out, fold it up, just hops in the suitcase, and away you go. Come out, blow it up.
And you also, you can get special seats to your car, you know, that just raise at the back. They're really good for just adding to a meditation cushion or a chair because they have that slope already in there, and they're really good foam. So quite easy to find those ones.
Yeah, so experiment, you know, find out what will work for you. Now, here's this one, sitting correctly, incorrectly. So you can see the one where it says sitting correctly, they've got this more support at the back. And like I said, what happens is that the body sort of naturally falls into this position. Whereas if you don't do that, you find yourself always pulling yourself up. Because what happens, you relax, you go down into your tummy, and then you can't get air in there. And so then the air stays up here, and that's no good. Because over time, you just become more and more tense. And this is the way we normally breathe, just at the top part of the lungs. So that brings a lot of excitement to the mind. The mind won't settle down. So you want it to become, you know, to nourish the whole body. And meditation becomes much more joyful that way. And it makes it easier. So this is a bloke called Marpa. So he was a great meditator in Tibet, and he was the teacher of a man called Milarepa that all the Tibetans revere. He's been one of the greatest meditators and the first lay person to get enlightened in Tibet. And so Marpa was his teacher. And he said, even if you combined all the profound oral instructions of Tibet, they could not compare to my system of sitting in the sevenfold posture of Virachana alone. Great claim, isn't
it? That's quite a statement.
So let's go first of all, like, who the heck is Virachana? So Virachana is one of the Buddhas. It's called Buddha Virachana. That's like we've got Buddha Shakyamuni, we've got Buddha Virachana, Buddha Ratnasambhava, Buddhas, blah, 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 lots of them. But Buddha Virachana is the symbol of the purification of the body, of the four aggregates. They go, Buddha Vajradhara sits like this. This is the way we should sit. So they do. And I'll show you the next slide, the seven things you do. Now, when you sit in this posture, there's a number of different things going on, and they're divided into two sections. One is called, these are the common benefits of sitting like this, and these are the uncommon. So the common benefits is that it facilitates or makes easy the generation of pliancy. So you go, what the heck is pliancy? So pliancy means that the mind is very easily able to move. It doesn't get stiff, but it's relaxed. Then when you get the mind pliant, then the body follows. You want pliancy in both, so the body's completely relaxed and the mind is relaxed. And it can move on the objects very easily and sit on them. So you want that. The other thing, it makes progress easy whenever you start to meditate. Thirdly, it's the behavior of Buddhists compared to non-Buddhists.
So which comes first, the posture or the mind?
Well, it depends. In the Zen thing, they go posture. You get the posture up, the mind will follow. They put a lot of influence on how you sit and making sure that you sit correctly. Then the mind will just naturally relax into it. And it's easier to work with the body than it is with the mind. So if you get the body right, mind often follows. And this posture is actually recommended by the Buddha himself and the the first lots of people from the Pali tradition called the hearers, they followed, they sat like this. Now, that's the common purposes, the common reasons. But the uncommon reason for sitting like this is that it really facilitates the movement of the internal energies of the body. And that is tremendously important later on when you go and practice Tantra, because you're really working with the inner energies rather than the mind. It's the energies that are really important then. So you do martial art training and sparring and stuff. It's about energy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty much using the energy itself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's the same here.
Yeah.
So you want to use the energy that's within us to support us in our practice. That's the uncommon purpose of sitting in this particular posture.
Yeah, so that's the similarity of the energy that's already there. Instead of trying to manufacture something new, it's that the energy that's there in martial arts with the other person, or the energy that's already there in our body,
yeah,
and just having it work, for us.
Yeah, so that's the uncommon reasoning behind this. So let's look at the posture. So as you can see, this is Lama Yeshe, who's the founder of one of the founders of the FPMT, and he's sitting in that posture now. So his legs are crossed underneath the robes, and he's got his hands in this particular mudra. And let's go through it. So first of all, the legs are in the Vajra posture, which means they're crossed over like this.
You've got the Buddha statue behind like the Buddha, you. Yeah. Tip your head one way, then.
They cross
the
legs
over. So
the feet rest on the right foot, rests on the left thigh. The left foot rests on the right thigh. That's called the Vajra position. They're crossed over like that. So if you try and do it yourself, if you've never done it, be really careful. So like you can put one up there, but then you try and put two up there. Now that's one struggle for me. It's like you reach your leg up. And if you get it, sometimes you just fall over. You just lose your balance. But if you can get it, it just locks you in.
It's very stable.
Very, very stable, which is great. So legs in that posture. And of course, the internal reason for this, in terms of the energy, it's to pacify jealousy and hatred. So it stops that type of mind arising. Because as you know, when you meditate, all sorts of thoughts arise. So this stops that type of thought, or the energy that goes with that type of thought. Then there's the hands, so the right hand goes to the left hand. So what's that mean? So the left hand represents wisdom. Wisdom and the female aspect. So left represents that. So it supports the method. Wisdom supports method. Method is cradled in wisdom. And when they put these two thumbs together like this, one of the major reasons for that is when they're lightly touching, you should be aware that they're lightly touching. And when they're not, because what happens often is the thumbs will go apart like this. You're getting drowsy. Things just slipped off. Say, oh, bring the thumb back. Touch the thumbs. So you become attentive once again. They've got this physical thing to help you do it. Keep the spine should be straight but relaxed. So it's not like, it's not lifting yourself and holding yourself tightly. It's like it's a natural thing. And if it's not, and you drop it, you'll know, because suddenly the tummy is like, comes in and out, just like that, and then you can't get the air down there. So you want to have it to start when you're, it's like you're walking or you're standing. So like in the martial arts, the horse stance, that posture, it's great for you because everything's in line. Like you can breathe the breath right down, get it right up, and breathe well. And this is really important because of the importance of the spine is to hold this, what we call the central channel, the central channel of all those energies runs along the spine. So you want that to run nicely and smoothly. Head and neck should be slightly bent forward and the shoulders level. So you'll find yourself oftentimes you need to sort of, as you're sitting and meditating, just do little checks on your body, because you'll find either your shoulders have crept up, or one is lower than the other, or you're leaning this way. All sorts of funny little things happen that you're unaware of. So, you know, you sort of tighten it up. Now with the head, with the head and neck, so you'll know you've got this nerve that runs along here, the vagal nerve, vagus nerve. It's a really important nerve. Oftentimes there's this thing that, especially like if you get really tight shoulders and tight neck, you can reach along here and find that nerve, and you want to start to manipulate it a bit. That comes in here. Oftentimes you can cup it. But even better is to get your finger in there like that and push it in and then lean towards it and lean away. It's amazing how that can change your whole feeling. There's really good stuff about this online. They give you these great exercises, you know, going along, well, there's the nerve, there it is, coming to there. Now just push it and you go, Jesus, you know, all right, you got it. Now lean into it. And it just relaxes it. But you'll know how tight your neck is and shoulders are with that nerve. So you want it loose and relaxed. Now jaws, as in the cup line to the eyes, man, the amount of tension that your jaw holds and your eyes. It's not surprising with the eyes because you're always looking. We use the eyes so much. But we put a lot of pressure on them, so they get sort of really tight around their eyes. So oftentimes it's a good idea to really, you know, close your eyes tight and then open them up. Other times it's a good idea to really rub your hands like this, do this, and get energy in your hands and then put them over your eyes. It just relaxes them, gives them like a bath of energy. So that's also a nice thing to do. Yeah, just like that. You'll notice the difference. The other thing you could do is put a smile on your face. So when you look at the Buddha, he's got a smile on his face. Now, there's a reason for that. The reason for that is this very, when you go up to the different stages of concentration, there's one level, the only way you can get to it is by putting a smile on your face. It makes the body supporting the mind.
It's a neurological thing.
Yeah. Neurological thing. So you've got it. That's how the change is made. The mental change is made through putting the smile on. If you start by putting a smile on your face, you relax about 80 different muscle groups immediately. That's an amazing benefit for us. I'd say, even if you don't and you imagine you're smiling, it'll do it.
But it's more than the muscle groups, because neurologically, if you put a smile on your face, it sends a message to your brain that you're happy.
Everything's
so you actually
all right.
Start feeling happy.
Yeah.
Because they're so closely associated, smiling and happiness, it actually works both ways. When you're feeling good, you naturally smile, but if you smile, you'll start naturally feeling happy.
Yeah. So we've rather use this information. I mean, it's been going on for 2,000 years. The meditation now is just tying up with Western science. So as we find it meets, we might as well use it. The other thing is about the tongue. So this is not a little bit unusual for us to do this, and it feels unnatural when you try it. But it's to put the tip of the tongue, behind the upper teeth. Now the reason for doing that is because once you get good at meditating, what will happen is that you can start to drool. And if you put your tongue up there, you won't. But it doesn't start dripping down your throat. That's really useful too. And finally, there are different instructions about how you use the eyes. Now, when we, you know, these centers, these Tibetan Buddhist centers, we often one of the major things to meditate on is what we call the land rim, the stages of the path. And it's a lot of reasoning going on. It's a lot of analysis. So when you do that, you're looking downwards. Because if you look up, you're going to get too excited. There's too much going on. So you're looking, your eyes, the instruction is to sort of look towards the tip of your nose, but like down. Like, so your eyes are open. They're not closed. They're looking down like this, but they're half open. But as long as you look, you don't need to look at the end of your nose. He makes his jokes about this. As long as you're looking like downwards.
You don't have to go cross-eyed.
Yeah, you don't have to go cross-eyed trying to find the tip of your nose. You just have to be looking downwards. That's that. For doing reasoning is you want to be in the body, like grounded, thinking along logically these different steps. But there are other different types of meditations where you can look straight ahead and the eyes have to be like open. And there's others when you look up. Now, if you are doing a lot of imaginative type of meditation, like you do something, oh, now just imagine all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are here. Now, that's when you want to be going up, bring your eyes up. Because if you look at any time when you say imagine something, where do the eyes go? So it helps you quickly bring the images into your mind. So we try and use our body as best we can to help us become familiar with these different topics. The other thing about keeping your eyes open is that as a practicing Buddhist, you'll find you're doing most of your practice out there in the world. You only do a small bit of meditating, don't you? But compared to the rest of our life, you might go half an hour a day, if you're really into it. That's 23 hours when you're not meditating. So if you're meditating for 1 hour a day with your eyes closed, you can't be walking around out in the world with your eyes closed. You need them open. So you know, while we're sitting here, like you keep your eyes open, you're thinking things like, why should I be kind to people? There's a reason for it. So you work out all these reasons, and then when you walk around the world, you keep your eyes open and you know why you should be kind to other people. You don't need to close your eyes to go, oh, why should I be kind? That's right. You don't do that, right? You keep your eyes open, you know. Of course, there are other ways to meditate too. So let's have a look at some of those. So walking or standing. So you know, in the Pali tradition in particular, there are a lot of walking meditations, mindfulness of walking, they call it mindfulness of the body. But that's another way of meditating. Standing, so a particular, what they call the mountain, standing like a mountain, this is a yoga posture, which is terrific. What you normally do is you stand up and tighten everything and then let it go. And your body just, that little go, just a little bit, you just stand there. It's terrific for breathing and thinking. It's like, I like it because, you know, you're steady. You're awake. You can't nod off. You can't fall asleep here. And the breathing is natural and you can feel everything. It's just terrific. Relaxed. There's also what they call in the martial arts, there's a type of stance called the horse stance. So I sort of like that too. You lower yourself a little bit more.
You have your knees bent.
Yeah, but it's like it makes you really grounded. And you can think directly, firmly. There's also, you can lie down. So over here, one of them is called the corpse pose. So some of you might be familiar with that in yoga. So what you're doing is you're lying like you're a dead person. Your arms, your hands are out like this, your legs are out, and you lie down like that. Put something underneath your neck so you're completely relaxed. What's really terrific about it is your back is naturally straight and supported by the ground. The thing is, it's so easy to fall asleep. That's why you want to keep your eyes open. But if you're going to meditate, keep your eyes open. Otherwise, it's too easy to go to sleep.
No way. I mean, I can't even do that in yoga because next minute I'm snoring. Yeah. It's very embarrassing. Yeah. Happens every time. Yeah.
Which just means you need more rest.
Yeah.
Means you're not resting enough. Yeah. But you know, the other thing is don't do it on the bed because your body knows when I'm in bed, I'm going to go to sleep. If you start lying, you will.
Yeah, the association is what begins.
Yeah. And the other one is called a lion pose. So this is the one where the fellow's lying on his side. He's on the right-hand side and he's blocking off the right nostril with one of his fingers. So you can train in this like for sleeping, but what it's actually is a posture preparing yourself for death. And the thing is here, when you block off that nostril, it stops angry thoughts arising. That's the idea, to control the wind, the energy in your body. Get on the right-hand side, block that right off, and now think about something virtuous. By blocking the nostril and being on that side, it has a huge influence on the channels on the right-hand side of the body.
Ages ago, you said something about women lying on each other's side.
Yeah, it just also depends on the tantras. But in general, if it's just sleeping, get on the right hand side. But if you're practicing a different type of tantra, then it could be different again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we've just got our seat, right? This is just about the seat. Now, once we're seated, we have to start working with the mind. We've started to work with the body by getting in the seat. Now it's the mind. But before you actually get to the mind, you can take another middle step. And what you do is you work with the breath. If you can calm the breath down, you've got the body calm, nice posture, now work with your breath. And there's all sorts of different ways you can work with the breath. One of the simplest is what they call counting the breath. So this picture is not about counting the breath, but we'll get to this one soon. A very simple one is like you sit down and on the in-breath, you can start counting a one. You go up to the top, come down, you go two, up, down, three, up, down, four, up, down. Right? So you just count up to 11 and then you count back down. And you'll know whether your mind has calmed down enough for you to set your motivation and so forth. If it's not, we need to count a bit longer. That's like for real beginners, right? Counting. It really helps you get grounded. Suppose you're pretty good already. You don't need to count. Just breathe in and breathe out and just keep an eye on what your mind is doing. And when you do that, again, if you find you've got a sort of excitable mind, like you do a lot of thinking anyway, you do a lot of worry or whatever, then ground the mind and the body at the abdomen. Like put it there so you can get the air down here. You know, oh, yeah, I'm breathing into my abdomen. That'll ground you and stop so much thinking. Because if it's up here where it normally is, you'll find yourself thinking. It's really hard to control your mind.
And you can get more anxious with that shallow breathing.
That's right. Yeah.
And Venerable Thupten Trotin also says, especially for women, if you're breathing, just let your belly be fat. Don't try and sit there and look thin, but just relax everything and breathe in the abdomen and let your belly stick out.
Yes, I had to learn that. So I had to learn how to sit and I had to learn to breathe because I realized like my breath was never getting down there. And I started off by doing the corpse posture because the only way I could put my hands on my belly to go, Jesus.
Nothing's moving.
It's not, there's no air going down there. So it took a lot of effort, you know. And so actually I learned to sit, learned to breathe, learned to walk. It was learned to stand. And this one took up yoga because I thought, man, like I'm so out of whack with my body. I don't know what's going on. You might find that with yourself. So you just go, it's okay, I'll just start from the beginning. What do you do? And what happens is meditation becomes easier and easier. So we've got these simple ones of getting fat and the air coming to your belly or counting. Or if you're good at that, you want to sharpen the breath, like with the nostrils here, it's really up to yourself. Or you can do what they call here the 9-round breathing meditation. Now, we're going to go, why this emphasis on the breath? First is to calm the mind down. Why do you want to do that? So that you can deliberately think. This is really important because this is where karma comes into it. Deliberate thinking is an action. That's karma. If we sit here and think, right, like I said to you in the beginning, why am I sitting here? And you say to yourself, I am going to meditate to become enlightened for the benefit of every living being. That's karma. You've just created good karma. Motivation is karma. Intention is karma. We need good karma. Good karma leads to happiness. So we deliberately think something. This is really good for us. But you can only do it if you're sort of calm enough, right, to think. Otherwise, your mind is just going to think itself. It creates its own crazy stuff. So we get the mind down enough so we've done the breathing. Now we can say these things. However, here's a solid way you can do it without even saying it. So what we do here is what they call cleansing the impure motivations with imagination. So what we're doing here now is instead of saying, I'm sitting down here, my intentions of being here today is to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. You can go, look, I know I've got a crazy mind, that's why I've come here. So to stop its craziness, I'm going to get rid of my anger and my lust and my ignorance, because these are the three major poisons of mind. How do you get rid of them? So you can sit there and you breathe in all the goodness. Okay, I'm surrounded by all the enlightened energies of all the Buddhas in the Bodhisattvas. Everything good surrounds me. I'm going to breathe it in. And on that exhalation, I'm going to breathe out all my rubbish. I'm going to breathe out all my anger. And I'm going to imagine it being like black. So I'm breathing all the white claret, white goodness, breathe out all the rubbish black. You might switch over to the other side and go, I'm going to breathe in all the goodness and breathe out all the rubbish, lust, desire, all the crap involved with that. It could look red. You just pull your hands away and go, now I'm going to breathe in all the goodness. And on the out-breath, I'm going to breathe out all the grey air, and that's all my ignorance. So you've got black, red, and grey, right, left, both together. And we just imagine it. And the most important thing is the imagination. So we've got these two ways of doing it. You can do it one with your imagination, or one you can deliberately calm yourself down and then say, this is what I'm going to do. Both work. Okay, so that's that. Now we come to the next thing, which is like, why are you actually here? What's the purpose? What are you trying to accomplish by meditating? So that leads us to this question, and hopefully we're going to answer it. So from a Buddhist point of view, we're trying to be the very best we possibly can. And this is sort of meaning going even beyond being an ordinary human being, but being a fully awakened being, a Buddha. That's the purpose of our lives. Now, to do that, there's a lot of stuff that stops us being a fully awakened person. And there's a lot of stuff we've got to do to be fully awakened. So the first thing is to remove the rubbish. So that's what we sort of did in our imagination before, wasn't it? We thought, oh, I'll get rid of all my hate and anger. I'll get rid of all my lust and desire. And I'll get rid of all my stupidity and ignorance. So these are called, what we're trying to remove is what they call the two obstacles.
Two obscurations.
Or two obstacles, two obscurations. What's obstructing us from enlightenment? So, these are the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. And I want to remove them. Why? Because they prevent me attaining Buddhahood. So that's one of the reasons you're here. The second thing is that you want to generate all the good qualities. So you want to generate the mind of enlightenment. You want to generate great compassion. You want to generate love and kindness. But not only do you want to generate them, you want to cultivate them. Thirdly, we want to support that mind of enlightenment with other qualities like love and kindness, compassion, equanimity, joyfulness, faith, all the other good positive qualities. So we want to develop them to use them to support this intention to become fully awakened for the benefit of others. And lastly, we want to achieve the state called Buddhahood. Now, this is supremely important. If you're at a Mahayana Buddhist center, the goal is enlightenment for others. It is not your own personal well-being at the expense of everyone else. If it's not enlightenment for the sense of for everyone, it's not Mahayana Buddhism you're practicing. That's why it's really important to have this clearly in your mind why you're here.
So that's quite different from like wellness retreats and things like that.
Yeah, so it's going well beyond wellness retreats. Buddhahood makes you supremely well, but a wellness retreat won't take you to Buddhahood. So one will bring you both, but the other will just bring you one. So in terms of Buddhahood, we will accomplish our own welfare. Don't worry about that, right? The lovely thing about it is you accomplish the welfare of others too. You can help others be happier, well-rounded, good people. But that's the point. It's not enough just to make ourselves this wonderful, well-rounded person who doesn't suffer. Because our parents will suffer, our children, everyone else has still got the same old problems. So we've got to have more than just one's own personal welfare at stake here. But this is not this intention, right? So we've sat down, we've calmed ourselves down for a breathing meditation if necessary, and we've set our motivation. Next stage is we use visualization to help us. And, you know, when we came here to start off, I said, you know, imagine you're surrounded by all living beings and all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are there. So what's the purpose of visualization or imagination? So you'll hear often, you go to Buddhist classes, they'll say, well, they won't always say it, but many people say, now visualize this and visualize that. So I've always found that difficult. But because I think visualize is like seeing what you see with your eyes, right? That's vision. And then you try to get that inside here, well, it's nothing like that for me. But if you said, just imagine, I'd have no problem doing that. And that's exactly what you're doing. You're imagining something.
Yeah, this lady in the class the other night was saying, I can't visualize anything. I'm just not visual. I'm like, but, you know, no one ever says, can you visualize your holiday? They just say, where are you going on holiday? What's it going to be like?
That's right.
Imagine your holiday, no problem.
No problems.
But visualize your holiday suddenly sounds like, sure.
Yeah, it's hard work, but we imagine all the time. We imagine about the past, we imagine our future, we imagine a whole lot of stuff we can do today. So we're always doing it. And this, we're doing the same thing here. All the only difference is we're imagining different things, things that we've deliberately decided to imagine. And the point of doing that is to bring us closer to the desired positive end state that we've imagined for ourselves, which is Buddhahood. But that's our goal. It helps if you can imagine it. Now, if you've ever studied or read about great athletes, the training of a great athlete is to imagine they have already won. That's what they do. It's the same here. We have to imagine we've achieved the state. And we imagine how it happened. So then this is what we said. Let's imagine all living beings surrounding us. Let's imagine our mother and father are there, our brothers and sisters, all the people we care about. Let's imagine the people we have a lot of problems with, they're in front of us. But let's imagine everybody else is a stranger. We're surrounded by them all, and they're all just like us. So you sort of, you know, bring a picture up so we feel, wow, I'm not just doing this for me, I'm not alone. I'm surrounded by everyone. And yet I'm going to lead everyone in the purpose of becoming enlightened, because there isn't anyone that likes to suffer and everyone wants to be happy. But so few people know how to do that. But I'm going to help them. And so look, we need to depend upon enlightened beings. There they are, right in front of us, Buddha, Bodhisattvas, they're all there right now. Just imagine they're there. Just feel as if they're there.
So Denny says, as Venerable Rabina reminds us, we're all excellent at imagining chocolate cake or ice cream. We've got a couple there, we can imagine dinner. But I'd also like to add that, you know, there's that saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And so, you know, people growing up in racist circumstances or impoverished circumstances is really important to be able to see or relate with what you want to be, and so that you can imagine it. And so this is what we're doing, isn't it? Meditation, we're actually seeing it so we can be it.
Yeah, I remember the story I always remember about people who say, I'm just no good visualizing. And I remember the teacher, this meditation teacher, saying to them, have you ever worried about anything? They go, oh, yeah, you can visualize. That is visualizing. Same thing, isn't it? But you know, you worry about something, guess what happens? You get affected by your worry, don't you? Straight away. But worries is imagination. It's like, okay, well, let's worry. Let's imagine something good, because it's going to affect us. It'll affect us in a good way. So that's why you use it. Or you can use imagination to get scared, which is also what you try and do in Buddhist stuff. It's not all about lights and Buddha bodhisattvas. It's about imagining some terrible things that might happen to you so they don't happen to you. They go, oh my God, I don't want that to happen to me. That's good. You have to do this thing. So visualization is a cognitive tool. It's a tool that we can use to realize the different aspects of an object. It's to remember or imagine someone or something. But it's by forming pictures in the mind. And they're done intentionally by us. Now, oftentimes when you, like if you go to sleep and you dream, it's not done intentionally by you, is it? It's just your mind just creates it. Other times, sometimes if you're just lying there, and next thing you can become quite depressed or sad. Well, your mind is doing that. You're not in control of it, but it's just running its show. And then you get to feel it and feel terrible. So with this, it's like, no, I'm going to run the show. I'm going to be my own producer and director. And this is the outcome I want. So you do it. And there's lots of material in the books that show you how to, you just say, well, just say this, do this, and da-da-da. But over time, you get good at it, just like anybody gets good at any craft they engage in. But you can make shortcuts. So, and this imagination process, you can try and use like all your senses. So when we say, just feel it. If you can't imagine it, just think that they're there. Just feel as if you're in their presence. There's a meditation that can be done. We actually hear the sound of the mantra. So you're imagining it already being heard. Someone else is saying it and you're hearing it. And then you do. Because that's the power of imagination. So you can use imagination to heal yourself or to relax or to make yourself afraid, all sorts of purposes. But the idea here is to go, you know, the major purpose here is to get enlightened. Enlightenment means you've got to go through different stages of practice, and imagination can help you. So when you find it can help you, use it. Yeah, yeah.
Surrender and stay.
Yeah. So So when I read about the movie producers or the great recording artists, it's already done in their mind, and they're just sitting there. I was thinking about these guys from Steely Dan. They're bringing in all these musicians, and they go, no, that's it. Okay, keep that bit. No, that's it. And the guy who's putting it all together, he's amazed. He says, they already know what it sounds like. I just have to put all the stuff together so it sounds like that. They go, yeah, that's it. Movie directors are the same. You know, they sit there, they can draw the whole thing out. Way out there, so the shot, they've already seen it all happen. All you have to do is do it. Then they do it, now here it is. So we're really, you know, we have to do a similar type of thing. Direct our own lives, direct our own imagination. And then, what's the other thing I said to you? Your nervous system and brain do not know what's real. Whatever you put in there, it thinks it's real. It'll always act as if it's real. There's no way I can say, oh, that's not real. It doesn't. It always responds as if it's real.
And this is a power that we can harness.
Yeah, that's right.
Because even like with the placebo effect, you know, with taking sugar pills and things and all of those tricks, like even if you know it's a sugar pill, just the action of taking it tricks your body into thinking that it's real. And I mean, that's an amazing thing to harness.
And that's been proven over and over again.
But Western medicine just thinks it's embarrassment and has to kind of work around the placebo effect rather than going, hello, this is just something really amazing.
Yeah, it's like, what is real? Mm-hmm. So, well, depends upon what your mind puts out there. Because your body and nervous system is going to respond to everything as if it's real. That's just what it does.
It's interesting, isn't it? A lot of the stuff of Western medicine or Western science trying to prove or disprove how some things work, what they don't, you know, study or try to measure is how much someone's using their imagination in the process.
Yeah, I just can't imagine. You can't measure the imagination. That's right.
And you can't measure imagination either. No, that's right. Too inconvenient.
Yeah. All you can do is measure the results. Mm. It's like, the person recovered. And then they go, we don't know how. Mm. We can't measure how. But he's like, well, you know, we use this imaginative process. And it worked. So, yeah, it's a very easy method to bring you closer to your own desired end state. That's a terrific, useful tool. In fact, a number of years ago, there was an Australian athlete that you were going to compete in the Olympics, and quite a few months out from it, she had an accident and wasn't able to train. So her coach said, I want you to sit in your chair and I want you to imagine how you're going to run that race. And so it was 400 meters. She's like, okay, in the first 100 meters, I'm going to go this fast and this is where I'm going to be. The next 50 meters, it'll be like this. So in her own mind, she mapped it, the race she was going to run to win the gold medal.
And she imagined
it winning. And what happened at the end? She came around that chair and she did exactly what she'd imagined and took the gold medal. I've got other books down there on sports psychology of imagining balls going into a basketball hoop. Massive difference if you imagine doing it without the imagination. And the same thing with playing pianos. Acting. So useful. But it also works the other way. If you think you can't do it, if you imagine yourself failing, then you always will. That's how powerful this, the imagination is. So here are some of the benefits of visualization. There are the heaps of them, right? You can remember the qualities. So this is why you have the Buddha statue behind it. You know, like, it's not, we're not worshipping the statue. You're still saying, well, what are the qualities of Buddhahood? Because that's what I want. I want to have immeasurable compassion, love, wisdom, the ability to help anyone spontaneously, effortlessly, wherever I am. So you look at a Buddha, you go, that's the fellow who did it. I want to be like that. And here with the light rays and things like that, that's part of it. Also, it draws you closer. So many people, before they get married, they're always imagining their spouse, aren't they? Guess what happens? Then they start to chase them. And then hopefully, if they want to, they get married. Or they have a relationship. But there's a lot of imagination that goes on before that takes place. And if they don't imagine it, it's not likely it's going to happen. So this is the idea, drawing closer to your desired qualities. Gives you greater confidence. And the other thing is enthusiasm.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to do as well. Like, it's a pleasant thing to do.
Yeah, that's right. It's pleasant to think about nice things, good things, isn't it? To imagine them. To imagine you being that way. That's on the positive side. Because the other side, of course, is terrible when you're imagining the worst things about yourself and the situations that could happen. Like, if you're imagining you're worthless and you can't do this and life's terrible and blah, 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 well, this has a massive effect on you.
And any often when that happens, you don't even know you're imagining. You just think you're going over the truth.
That's right. That's right. It's true. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. Your body and mind don't know what's true. It behaves as a man. Anything you put in there is true. So you should put in the good stuff. When you come to visualize, or when you come to imagine, there's different ways you can do it. So often they say, like, get the big picture, but then narrow in on the smaller parts of it. So it's like having a painting. You know what you want to paint, but it doesn't all go up there at once. You know, you sketch it in, and you gradually fill it in, and finally end up with a painting. So, like, when you imagine the Buddha, and so, you know, like, so I just said, imagine the Buddha, right? So in my mind, so I've got a golden being sitting up there, lights coming off them. The advice they give you for when you imagine the Buddha, so you might get a general picture of some golden, glowing person in front of you. What you want to narrow in on is the eyes. Buddha is looking at you. So in your imagination, you should think, I'm being seen by the Buddha. The Buddha is looking at me.
Recognizes me.
Recognizes me. That's where we get this, I'll put these eyes up. But so when we look at this, this is symbolic. So when you look at the Buddha, we said, not like an ordinary human being. It's meant to be a figure of golden light. So why light? The reason for that is because we can't imagine emptiness. But we can't imagine light. And emptiness is the ultimate mode of being. So we can light. So we're directly impacting our mind with the ultimate way of things. And all things are empty. Yet because it's light, they exist. So the light comes at us. And the light, of course, is wisdom, compassion, all the colors and all that stuff. That's the method side. So when the lights of the Buddha shine on us, we are being enveloped in love, compassion, acceptance, it's white light, wisdom, all that stuff. But the idea that it's light is to remind us that it's all empty. It's all dependently arising. So that we don't cling to it. So that we don't grasp it as something intrinsic and real. But you know, like I said, these eyes, when they look at us, so in the eyes, I don't know, you can see it up there, but they've got this red tinge around. So all the colours mean something. It's all symbol. It's all symbolic. So the red means bliss. Buddha is the state of bliss. So the white, of course, is the purity. The other has got this blue little thing there. It's like the spaciousness, the absolute. So, quite isn't it? It's like we're creating something, right? It's all symbol, symbol, symbol. It's like language is symbol, all of it. It's pointing to something. So when we look at it, when we see it, it's looking at us. We are, it's like wisdom is coming back at us. Bliss is coming back at us. Which it is in a way, isn't it? It's like we've created it through our imagination. It's not anywhere else. It's being experienced by us.
That's what I remember you saying, that after all of this imagination of the Buddha arising and everything, and then you say, so where is this all happening?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's all in my mind.
One of the other benefits of when you imagine the Buddha looking at you, seeing you, always present, which is omniscient. What's terrific about that is that whenever you have ideas of doing something stupid or silly, you're going to hesitate. Yeah? Because you're in the presence of somebody who's looking at you. But they see what you're doing. And your wisdom does see what you're doing. It just helps a great deal if you think it's the other.
The better one.
The better one. The better me looking at me. That's right. So I think it's very skillful psychology. Anyway.
I was thinking about Susan says, with regard to imagination, if you think you can or you think you can't, then you're right.
That's it.
Yeah. And then she said also, Wayne Dyer, I'm not sure who that is, said, you'll see it when you believe it.
Yeah, that's right. So what's our takeaway for today with our class has come to an end? Well, you do know about different suits, and you know about posture, and you know something about why relaxation is important and the straight spine, and the benefits of imagination. So I hope you'll take this away and use them. So in terms of material, you can have a look at for next week's class. Have a look, there's pages 5 and 6 and 18 and 19 in the LTC notes. This is up online, of course. Keep trying to bless your speech. In terms of memorization, move into the seven limbs of practice. Now, reverently, I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I make offerings of actual momentum. Even if you can't like recite it like I just did, go, well, what's the first thing I do? It's prostration. And then there's offering. Then there's confession. So just number it. Because it's all done in your imagination here. You know, so you just go, the first thing I'm going to say is prostrating from the Buddha. So I'm going to offer him something. Then I'm going to say, look, I'm really sorry about what I did. I'm going to confess what I did. They're going to feel so glad I confessed. They're going to feel so happy everybody's good. So just step, 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 and you change your mind. The mind goes through a process. And next week, we're going to look at refuge, the four immeasurables, and add a bit more about everyday dharma. Anything? Yeah. Anything final anybody would like to add or ask? Or so yeah, I see you've stayed to the end. We've kept you here. Okay. So we've put some effort into understanding. You've put effort into staying here, sitting here, listening to me. You've put effort into trying to understand what's going on. And I do think you'll put effort into doing it. So let's take this effort, which is called merit, and we're dedicated towards our final goal of enlightenment. So I think, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, we are quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. And finally, May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And while space exists and there are beings to be found within it, may we too remain to dispel all sufferings that they experience. There we go. Thank you, everybody. But thanks for everyone online. I hope you enjoyed the class and you've got to put something into practice. And we'll see you again next Tuesday. If we're not dead. Right.
Susan says that was it. Thanks, very valuable session today.
Yeah, thank you, Susan.